Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Well, this year marks the final year of centenary commemorations of the Irish Revolutionary Decade, 1913 to 23. And today we're going to look at the pivotal events of 1923 and what will be or should be remembered and commemorated this year, 100 years on. Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern History in UCD, is here. Good morning to you.
Morning, Claire.
1923, a messy year.
It's very dark. And January 1923 is particularly dark. There were 34 official executions in January alone in 1923 as a result of the Civil War. And that decision, of course, the crucial decision had been made at the end of 1922, a public safety resolution, which allowed for these executions. And once you begin doing that as a government, you can continue doing it. And the official government line is that they have to vindicate ordered government. That's the line that's used by Kevin O'Higgins, one of the senior government ministers. And it's, of course, also a highly local dynamic as 1923 progresses, because there are parts of the country where there is mayhem, where anti-treaty Republicans have retreated to their Munster heartland and they are effectively engaging in a guerrilla campaign. And the difficulty is trying to snuff that out, because clearly in conventional military terms, the National Army side have decisively defeated the Republicans. But the challenge is to actually end the campaign altogether. And that becomes very, very difficult, particularly as they retreat. And it leads to greater desperation and a lack of discipline and a breakdown in sometimes communications. And the anti-treaty Republicans are clearly aware that the odds are stacked against them, but they're fighting an intense propaganda battle that suggests they can finally bring the Free State to its knees. So there's a lot of delusion. And it's very interesting that Eamon de Valera, as the leading political figure of the anti-treaty side, in private is acknowledging that they have to find a way out, that they need to pursue a strategy which will give them some kind of moral high ground if they look for peace, that they can claim some form of successful resolution.
You mentioned the decision, the formal decision taken to embark on this strategy of arrest, trial and execution. But that changed and it made it easier to prosecute those people on the anti-treaty side who are deemed to be still engaged in warfare.
Well, due process goes out the window. I mean, there's no question about that. It was deliberately made easier for local National Army commanders. If they were in a particular part of the country, they would contact Dublin and say, we have to deal with what we're facing now in this region, in this area. Can we have authorisation to execute these individuals in retaliation for what they have done? It becomes far too easy. Due process goes out the window. These people are not put on trial. They're mostly low-ranking members of the IRA. And that in itself is a deliberate strategy. They're not taking the very high-profile individuals. Liam Deasy, one of those high-profile individuals, was arrested in February 1923. And he was spared execution because he agreed to call on his colleagues to surrender. And that caused a lot of dissension, obviously, within the anti-treaty IRA. But certainly there are individuals who become associated with terrible deeds, particularly in Kerry in March 1923. And people will be familiar with the place names Ballyseedy and Knocknagoshal, a booby trap, five National Army soldiers killed. And then in retaliation, there were eight anti-treaty Republicans taken out of jail in Tralee, tied around a mine. The mine was detonated. Of course, famously, there was one survivor, Stephen Fuller. And the level of trauma that was generated as a result of these summary executions, or roadside executions as they were known, was massive. And think of the members of Cumann na mBan, for example, the women in Kerry in March 1923 who were charged with the task of collecting the body parts after the Ballyseedy explosion. And we know from pension applications now that decades later they were still dealing with the after effects of that.
Understandably.
Those scenes don't leave you. Most families, of course, did not know until after the executions had happened that their loved ones were dead. And they didn't get the bodies back. And the bodies are not returned until 1924.
How were the families informed?
They were informed very curtly by telegram that their sons had been executed that morning, and that they were buried where they were executed. So there's no question of the families getting access to the bodies. So that adds another layer of difficulty. And of course, there's a ruthlessness on the part of the anti-treaty IRA as well. Liam Lynch, as chief of staff, recognises again that they have to change strategy over the course of 1923. They have to try and target infrastructure and government buildings and revenue generating processes to try and complicate the business of government, to make it very difficult for the state to get up and running. But they also embark on a campaign of attacking the houses of prominent Free Staters and supporters of the government. De Valera in private suggests to Liam Lynch that this is both puerile and futile. And there's an interesting and tense correspondence between the two of them, representing the military wing and the political wing of that side. And of course, the more damage that's done to the infrastructure, the blowing up of bridges, the destruction of railway lines, again, the more ruthless the government responds.
And the government fear was that they were going to run out of money to run this new state, and that there would be a return to what we had before, and that the British would put troops on the street again.
The argument that they make is that we have to not just vindicate the idea of order government, but vindicate the idea of self-government. We cannot be dependent on outside assistance to get this state up and running. And you could see, we mentioned this last year before the death of Michael Collins, how obsessed he became with money and ensuring that those who were attempting to illegally seize government money and revenue, that they would be targeted. So there's certainly a preoccupation with finances. One of the reasons why customs checks, for example, are introduced on the border between the Free State and the new Northern Ireland in February 1923 is to try and ensure that there is another stream of revenue, that the Free State cannot rely to the same extent as Northern Ireland can on a solid revenue basis. And that in itself further cements the border. And even James Craig, as Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, is saying, you know, you're the ones who are creating partition now by imposing this new, what we would call today a harder border,
yes,
or a hard border in relation to customs checks and so on. It didn't have a huge economic impact in the 1920s. It's more in the 1930s that smuggling becomes a big problem. But it does affect the border counties. And it is, again, an indication of the social and economic challenges that the government are facing alongside the actual civil war challenge.
So April then was the key month. That was when the civil war was declared over, wasn't it?
Well, it was the death of Liam Lynch that really brought it to an end. Liam Lynch as Chief of Staff, for all his reputation as a ruthless anti-treatyite, we know from his private meanderings that he too was looking for a way out. They were recognising that they would have to try and engage in some form of negotiation. But of course, the Irish government is not going to negotiate. But he is killed. Himself and a number of senior IRA officers are billeted in a cottage in the Knockmaledown Mountains. And there's intelligence that the National Army side has, and they locate him and they go after him. And this is his grisly end. I mean, there's six of them in trench coats, in their IRA trench coats. They're only armed with handguns and they're facing a much better equipped National Army. And he's shot. And of course, he spends his last few moments with a National Army soldier who had been in the IRA during the War of Independence. So there's that added poignancy to these deaths as well. But that really took the heart out of the anti-treaty IRA campaign. And his successor, Frank Aiken, who always hated civil war and hated, even in later stages, talking about it, he recognises that he is going to have to call for a ceasefire. And that call duly comes at the very end of April. And then there's an order to dump arms on the 24th of May 1923. So you could say that it formally comes to an end. But violence only dribbles away. And that's the interesting thing about the... there's still a very solid basis of support for anti-treaty Republicans. That's reflected, for example, in a general election in August 1923, where they win 44 seats, 27% of the vote. It's still a very solid bloc. But they have to devise a new strategy. And this offers De Valera a way out, because his argument increasingly throughout 1923 is that I need to shepherd these men onto the political path, and we need to pursue our aims like that. And the way he put it in 1923 is that the phase of the struggle that was begun in 1916 has now run out of road. So we have to come up with a new strategy. Mm-hmm. Of course, by the summer of 1923, De Valera is in prison in Armagh Hill because he's arrested in August 1923 and he spends the guts of a year in prison, which wasn't necessarily the worst thing for him at that stage. It allows him time to think and reflect on what has happened and devise a strategy for the future vindication of the Republican cause.
Which would be acceptable to those people who had fought in that war.
Yeah, I mean, they're still, of course, not going to take their seats in the Dáil. The August 1923 general election is very interesting because the pro-treaty side party wins 63 seats. You have 44 for the anti-treaty side, for anti-treaty Sinn Féin. The Labour Party is getting squeezed. The farmers actually do better than the Labour Party in the 1923 general election. But there they are with their 44 seats. where do they go with that particular mandate? That was exercising De Valera's mind, obviously, during that period, which is why 2 years later he decides to establish Fianna Fáil and break the links, essentially, with Sinn Féin.
What was life like here in 1923?
It was very tough. There was an awful lot of poverty. There were 800,000 people living in overcrowded conditions, according to the 1926 census. There were still 28,000 families in Dublin living in one-roomed tenements. It's very interesting to look at the work of Sean O'Casey, the playwright, during that period, because he has his first play accepted by the Abbey Theatre in 1923, in April 1923, The Shadow of a Gunman. And there's a note in the programme to remind the audience that if they hear shots, they're not real. They are part of the play. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder of the atmosphere in which that play was staged.
Very surprising that was commissioned and put on a stage at that time, very close to the bone.
It was very close to the bone, but I mean, this was part of the great achievement of Sean O'Casey to be able to do that in the 1920s. He has been described in one sense as one of the first revisionist historians of the revolution, because he's highlighting the humanity, but also the hypocrisies and those who were on the margins. You know, was life going to change as a result of this revolution for the people in the tenements? Shadow of a Gunman is set during the War of Independence in 1920, and it's set in Hilljoy Square, which is a tenement in Dublin. And you have the very interesting characters and the struggle, as O'Casey would see it, is also a struggle that's social and economic. I mean, the socialist message is very clear. And there were a number of writers during that period who were involved in trying to come to terms with the new dispensation. Sean O'Fallon was a young anti-treaty Republican, and he made the point that the Civil War had woken them up from, as he put it, the mesmerism of the romantic dream. And it set us asking questions about the pre-sanctified dogmas of our history. And he said, we were blessed with writers who had the courage to face experience and record it. And Sean O'Casey was one of them. He wasn't actively involved in the struggle because he was a disciple of James Larkin. And as far as he was concerned, the Republicans were involved in the wrong struggle. But he also brings that authentic Dublin vocabulary to life and to stage, which is a real novelty. It's a very clever move by the Abbey Theatre to engage him.
Absolutely.
In that way.
Beyond the city, though, I suppose the major concern was about the division of land, the ownership of land, who gets what. And we have the Land Act, the Hogan Land Act. This was in August of 1923.
Yeah, Paddy Hogan was a very influential minister as Minister for Agriculture. And the way he saw it, economic development was synonymous with agricultural development. So to go back to this question of the economic and social challenge, it's apparent that there are 300,000 people living on what are termed uneconomic holdings. There are about 33,000 people who are living on the bigger estates or the bigger farms. And then there are over 100,000 people who are living on less than 1 acre. So there's a huge imbalance in rural Ireland, in the social structure of rural Ireland.
Were they formerly tenants?
These were formerly tenants. Some of them, of course, had become owners of their own land, but some had not. So the idea of the 1923 Act is partly to finish the process that had begun under all the land legislation, pre-independence land legislation, but also to reconstitute the Land Commission so that it is given powers to acquire land, to compulsorily acquire land, and to redistribute it. And by 1987, 1.5 million acres have been acquired and redistributed. This was a huge social change. Paddy Hogan estimated it would cost about £30 million to vindicate these demands for redistribution and greater access to land. But it's a massive issue that's associated with the Civil War as well.
Was that not hugely divisive at the time?
It was, but
Compulsory
purchase and compulsory acquisition of land by the state. But it also worked, and it was a measure of the crisis and of the urgency of the crisis that the state had to intervene to that level, because rural Ireland was not going to settle and the Civil War was not going to settle if this attention was not given to the land problem, to the social problem. So it's a very active state intervention, and it's a priority for them. And you can see that even in the midst of civil war, they are recognising that there are problems of land seizures, of cattle seizures, of all of these local struggles that are going on that revolve around land and revolve around historic claims to land.
On the international stage then, Ireland is admitted to the League of Nations in 1923.
This is quite a moment in September 1923, and you'll hear a lot of talk this year about Ireland finally taking its place amongst the nations of the world. And there is a degree of truth in that. There was quite a degree of excitement within the Secretariat of the League of Nations at the idea of admitting Ireland. The First Dáil had actually passed a resolution and a vote in favour of League of Nations membership in April 1919. That seemed pie in the sky, of course.
Yeah.
And I mean, they envisage a republic going into the League of Nations. What they get, though, is the Free State going in. The Free State representative in Geneva at that time was Michael McWhite. And there was a lot of work going on behind the scenes to try and prepare Ireland for membership and to make it relevant to Ireland so that it would not just be preoccupied with the Anglo-Irish dimension, because there's the concern about the Commonwealth of which Ireland is a part. But this offers them an opportunity, in the words of Desmond Fitzgerald, who was the Minister for External Affairs, to take their place alongside other European countries.
Hugely significant.
Yeah, that
and
we
symbolic.
Are a free country, that we are an independent country, and that we can be critical participants in this League of Nations. I mean, the League of Nations was a very flawed organisation, but it does offer an international stage. And by 1930, Ireland has been elected to the Council of the League. And it's an indication of the shrewdness that was developing amongst the diplomats who were involved in that kind of work.
But the problems still linger from the Civil War at that point in the year, later in 1923, and you have the hunger strikes which were embarked upon by interned Republicans. Why?
And again, they want to be released. And as far as they're concerned, they are being illegally held. And by the end of the Civil War, there are between 12 and 13,000 Republicans interned, men and women. They embark on a hunger strike in October 1923. It spreads to over 10 camps and prisons and internment centres. It began in Mountjoy. It's estimated that between 7 and 8,000 people participated. It's very difficult to coordinate and sustain. 41 days. Some prisoners remained on hunger strike. And you can imagine the long-term mental and physical consequences of that. But it was difficult to sustain. There was exhaustion. A lot of the energy had gone out of the fight. A lot of the prisoners come off the hunger strike after a couple of weeks. But there are very distressing scenes. There's a famous book by Frank O'Connor called Guests of the Nation, and he was another interned Republican during the Civil War. And he describes a very distressing scene when it is called off. And there's this rush to the barbed wire as the sentries are bringing over buckets of soup. And these prisoners are thrusting their hands and their mugs to the barbed wire and they're tearing their hands. And some of them are getting sick and they're coming back for more. And one who was not on the hunger strike and didn't approve of it turned around to Frank O'Connor and he said, "Well, Professor, the pigs feed." And Frank O'Connor writes about how he turned away in disgust because that's exactly what the scene resembled. And he said this was the end of our magical improvisation. So there was a real sense by then that this was the final chapter.
That was a difficult problem, though, for the state to deal with, because to release all of those prisoners, I'm sure they would have perceived that that would be a threat to the state.
Oh, no doubt about that. Absolutely. Because these prisoners don't recognise the legitimacy of the state. They can be released if they sign an agreement that they will recognise the legitimacy of the state, that they will abide by the rules. Some of them eventually do that. Many more do not. The prisoners begin to be released. But some of them are still incarcerated up to 1924. And we have the Civil War correspondence of Ernie O'Malley, who actually stayed on hunger strike for 41 days. And he was obsessed with the spirituality of the movement and the need for more sacrifice. But he's not really representative of the rank and file. Many of them need to get back to civilian life. But of course, many of them are not going to reconcile themselves to the new state. And substantial numbers of them actually left the country, men and women.
So then it's difficult, isn't it? Again, we're talking about commemorations. To figure out how this, as you put it at the beginning, this dark year should be remembered.
Well, the state needs to commemorate, formally commemorate the Civil War. It needs to devise a way to do that. And this is, of course, about a theme, as they would see it, of reconciliation. You know, it's not about attributing blame to either side, but it's about recognising the scale of the devastation and the illegal things that were done on both sides and the kind of war that it became. It's up to the government to devise a way of doing that. There are going to be, I suspect, a lot of local events to commemorate particular aspects of the Civil War and particular atrocities during the Civil War. I mentioned Kerry, for example. But there were also executions in Ennis, in Tuam, in the workhouse. I mean, even after Liam Lynch was killed. So people at local level will, I presume, devise ways of remembering that and of reflecting on that. You don't obviously celebrate Civil War. You don't mark it in that way. And this has been a challenge internationally. Countries like Finland, for example, had to come up with ways to acknowledge the horrors of what happened in their Civil War in 1918. And there are are a variety of different ways that you can do it. But ultimately, you don't seek to avoid the reality of what Irish people did to each other. That is an essential part
to face
of
it.
Our legacy. And it also has massive implications for the kind of state that we became subsequently.
Dermot, thank you very much. That was 1923. Professor Dermot Ferriter, back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.